The weekend is near and the next round of footy is finally upon us. And your ultimate guide to all the upcoming action lies within the Fox Footy Podcast Bunker. Welcome to Match Committee.
When you sign up to work in the footy media industry, you sign up to report the news, not necessarily be the news. But over recent days, a peer has found himself at the centre of a perplexing story, a yarn that ultimately derived from perplexing club breaches. Five clubs, five brackets, half-suspended, end brackets, fines, one big weekend for the AFL, all when Victorians moved to stage four lockdown restrictions. The stranger times only get stranger, so who better to break down the strangeness than three stranger-than-average individuals on the Fox Footy Podcast. Ben Waterworth with you, as is the number one ticket holder to the Alicia Molik fan club, Tom Morris. Hello, Thomas.
Hello, Ben. Hello, Max. Yeah, well, who would have thought at the start of the year we'd have a story where a club was being fined $50,000, 25 of which has been suspended, for playing tennis with Alicia Molik in Perth in early August.
Or this story is so in your wheelhouse, Tom.
It was. I mean, there was a few whispers going around on Saturday that they were playing tennis with someone outside of the bubble. And then the whispers became it was a former Australian tennis player. So I did a bit of research and through my tennis contacts and I found out that Alicia Molik is really the only high-profile former Australian tennis player living in Perth. Someone suggested to me it could have been...
Excuse me. Sorry. Margaret Court.
Sorry. Recently retired. And Margaret Court's your favourite person, Max. I know that.
Oh, yes.
Just not get political. And then someone said to me it was Sam Stosur. And I thought, that's ridiculous. Sam Stosur's in Melbourne. She's just had a kid with her partner. So... I did a bit of research and yes, Alicia Molik was the person. Then I actually sought to get an interview with Alicia Molik through my contact and I was promptly told that Alicia Molik did not want to talk about it and that was it.
And that's fine, it's play on and that's her right, but it was certainly right in your wheelhouse for footy and a former world number eight to collide in such a big story. You also heard the voice there of our top eight fortune teller at foxfooty.com.au, Max Lawton. Hello, Maxie.
Hello, Ben. Hello, Tom. Yes, a lot of Fed Cup chat over the last week, of course, with Alicia Molik, and a lot of top eight chat because we're over halfway through the season. A lot of teams have played nine games. Some have played 10 now because, of course, we're recording this midway through a round, which is the weirdness of this footy frenzy.
And we'll get to the run home in a tick because you've done a really nice job on the Fox Footy website, breaking it all down for where every club sits and the hardness or the easiness of their respective draws. But let's sort of start, or not necessarily specifically on the Pies again, but the whole COVID protocols breaches, which kind of reared its ugly head later last week. And then they just sort of across sort of 3 days, Tommy, there's some club breaches just sort of drip fed out. And it started with three clubs on Thursday being linked, added to Hawthorn on Friday, and then the Pies sensationally on Saturday. It's been tough to sort of keep your head on the ground to it.
Yeah, there's been a lot going on. I think the clubs have generally behaved pretty well in this period in a difficult time. But clearly when you have families involved, when you have young men involved that are prone to making mistakes and when they're in foreign environments and when they're being restricted on what they can and can't do, and some of these areas are understandably grey because they haven't lived in this environment before, there's going to be mistakes to be made. But I didn't think there'd be so many mistakes in such a short period of time. So Richmond with Cochran, Carlton with a couple of players' kids who went to a theme park with grandparents, North Melbourne who had some wives and partners who went to the footy, Hawthorn who had a couple of players who went to get a bucket of chips while watching a game that their team was playing in.
That's the best one.
Escorted by security. And then Collingwood, whose coach and senior assistant played tennis with Alicia Molik. It is a bizarre season, but I don't know where you guys sit. I said it to Kingy and Joey on First Crack. I don't actually have a lot of sympathy for people who make errors. I've got sympathy for the football clubs and the players and the coaches for being away from home and potentially being injured for the players and being under pressure for coaches and having to win and wanting to play finals and not being sure what's ahead of them next year in terms of contracts. But the rules, as far as I can see in the pamphlet that I've been shown, are pretty clear. So I don't really know. I know Buckley's a pretty intelligent guy, but he's made a mistake. But I don't think there's too many more chances that's going to be afforded to many other clubs before the sanctions increase.
Just on the on Buckley and the Pies specifically, there was a little bit of talk that, well, supposedly you can play tennis or do some kind of recreational activities with people outside of the bubble. But that, does that all depend on timing, Tom? Like, should that can't be so close to game day?
I'm actually not 100% sure about the timing. The timing of Nathan Buckley and Alicia Molik playing tennis, this is just according to what Buckley said, there's a bit of a grey area because it was a bit closer to game day, so therefore they had to be more in the bubble, I guess, for lack of a better term. They did play tennis, Sanderson and Buckley, on the Wednesday as well. That was just with each other.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure exactly because the rules are changing all the time. The stipulations, I can understand, are a bit grey, but why I don't have a lot of sympathy is because all they need to do is just ask the question. Bucks or whoever it is just needs to say to the COVID officer within the club, hey, can I do this? And then they'll get an answer. So even though it might be a little bit grey, it can be black or white if you just, pardon the pun, if you just ask the question immediately. And a good example of that is that a couple of weeks ago, the AFL sent a letter to clubs who transferred the information to players that they weren't allowed in each other's rooms in hubs. The players weren't happy. They complained to the AFLPA, who then negotiated with the AFL, and it was then emailed to the players on last Friday that they could be in each other's rooms, but for a maximum of 2 hours and no more than within a meter and a half of each other. So the rules can change, but simply asking the question should be pretty easy, I would have thought, Max.
You would think, and that would be my first decision whenever I was trying to do anything if I was in the hubs right now, would be just double checking, is this okay? And really, you could solve this by just playing singles, not doubles. It's probably a fair rule for tennis matches at the moment, to be honest. Yes. Safest sport in the land is singles tennis. I don't know. I understand why there was a bit of concern about the penalties and how they were very equal, even though the Collingwood coach playing tennis with someone outside of the bubble, as compared to North Melbourne being told they can bring family members to a game, but then being told no, they weren't allowed to, and there being a lot of confusion around that. And I think that the Roos actually put out a relatively strongly worded statement saying that they were told that it was okay, but okay will cop the fine.
Yeah.
It's a really confusing area, and I understand we have to be safe because, as everyone keeps bringing up, we're one mistake away from the season falling apart if a state government says, nope, you've done too much.
And I suppose, from a North Melbourne perspective, they made it pretty clear that when it was sort of first being reported that they were potentially considering fighting the fine. But as you mentioned, they ultimately took it on the chin in the end. I suppose the biggest burning question here is sort of how was Buckley's tennis form against Molik? And two, if there was a player you could compare Buckley to as a tennis player, like, are we thinking sort of in the Goran Ivan Isovich kind of mode? Evgeny Kafelnikov or sort of those kind of areas?
Max, I know you're the tennis man here and you do great work at the Australian Open, but I think he's a calculated, measured, borderline a Soviet automaton type Pete Sampras. Serve and volley, not much emotion, just gets the job done.
I was thinking Gustavo Kuerten, naturally. Or maybe a Tim Henman, even.
Henman?
Tim!
What, so
on the hill. Well, Henman could never win Wimbledon, and, you know, Buckley hasn't won a flag, so...
Oh, wow, that is brutal for me.
Factually correct.
It is factually correct. The other thing that's factually correct as well is that Brooke Cotchin posted a picture of her about to enter a Queensland-based day spa that ultimately came central to what has been a bizarre story, it has to be said, basically since Sunday night, which saw an AFL media employee, Mitch Cleary, who we've got a lot of respect for on this podcast, was temporarily stood down, then reinstated back into, and then sort of came back in via his own podcast yesterday. Tommy, it's been you were quite strong on first crack on Sunday night. It's been a very strange set of circumstances.
Very strange, yeah. I think the AFL made a disgraceful decision, and I'm happy to say that. I've said it on first crack. I think I've said it on Twitter. I think the AFL embarrassed itself because if the media wing of the business, if the editorial wing of the business is not independent, then we should know about it. Don't pretend that it, and Eddie Maguire said this as well on Triple M, don't pretend that they're independent if they're not. So if there's complete independence, then Mitch Cleary should be able to post whatever he wants, regardless of if it tarnishes the AFL's values. And by the way, this was posted on social media, so it's not like he did something, I think, ethically wrong anyway, but that's probably another argument. If they're not independent, tell us. And then their PR wing, I think it calls into question the true underlying value of that part of the business. And I feel sorry for Mitch that he was caught in the middle of it. And I also feel sorry for him that he was wrapped up in a pretty ordinary media release where he was, I assume...
You're quite strong on that. So you sort of try to talk people through the spin of that.
Yeah, well, I think he was told that you've got to admit wrongdoing, otherwise you're not coming back. Now, I don't know that for a fact. But that just reading it, I'm like, this is an embarrassing media release where the AFL... And look, there were the AFL executives who, 24 hours earlier, were resolute to people I was speaking to up in hubs in Queensland, saying, no, Mitch has done the wrong thing. He deserves to be stood down. And then 24 hours later, he gets reinstated. So there was clearly a lot of backlash. Also, even if he has done the wrong thing, surely the AFL can read the tea leaves and see that the backlash is going to be huge for standing down a journalist for doing his job. And they don't stand him down. They might make him call Cochran, or they might say, oh, can you just offer an apology to Richmond, or do whatever you want. But standing him down was the worst PR decision of all of them. And there's been a few. So the AFL's had a really bad few days. You just hope that if they are allowed to report independently in the future, they can do so without fear or favour. Because people sort of scoff at the whole idea of being in a democracy and the role of the media. But what's become clear in the last few days is people have never really liked journalists, or there's a sort of a lack of trust for journalists in the media, which I completely understand, which has sort of been amplified by the fake news phenomenon and Donald Trump and the whole lot on a global scale. But people hate the AFL even more because Mitch Cleary had almost unanimous support. Very rare that a journalist has almost unanimous support. It just shows how badly the AFL stuffed up in this case. And for anyone, you know, occasionally I get people sort of tweeting me or telling me, oh, you know, Fox Footy is just a puppet of the AFL. But I think we've got great independence with our website and the work we do. And the fact that I feel free enough to say that the AFL's had a terrible few days and it's disgraceful what they've done and they've embarrassed themselves probably illustrates that.
Yeah, so there's a few things to dissect here for me. One is the specifics of the Cleary situation where the AFL made the decision that we are not going to put out any of these names of the family and friends who broke these rules because they're not in the AFL bubble. And I can understand the AFL coming to that decision and not putting the names in the statement.
Yes.
But
yes.
The fact that the AFL's decision became AFL Media's decision, in essence, the statement said it was an editorial decision, but it has been spoken about. The Sounding Board this morning podcast, Damian Barrett talked about how the AFL made the decision not to name the players, and that's the rule Mitch Cleary broke. Therefore, he is not breaking an AFL media rule. He's not breaking a journalist rule. He's breaking an AFL organizational rule.
Yeah.
That in itself speaks to the conflict of those two businesses, really. And
well,
that's
one
problem.
Business.
Well, yes, exactly. But theoretically, two businesses, because one's a media arm that's covering itself. And that's what makes it so complicated. The second thing is a broader point about media independence. And yes, Fox Footy is independent to the AFL, but Australia more broadly has a issue with media independence and how concentrated all our ownership is. Let's not get into that too much, but there are always going to be conflicts. There are always going to be stories that some outlets can't report that others can because of TV networks they own, sporting teams they own, etc. That's what makes everything so difficult in this country, and this is just another example of that for mine.
Yeah, I agree. So if you're right. If we wanted to write, I don't know, that a Fox Footy commentator is embarrassing himself or herself on air, we probably couldn't write it because we work for Fox Footy. I completely get that. But I was always under the impression, and they told us, that AFL media is independent from the AFL, and this just proves it's not, Ben.
Well, yeah, it has been fascinating. I think the support that Mitch has got, which he said as well, has been overwhelming. And I agree that the temporary standing down was a bit over the top. I think ultimately, if Mitch had filed a story to the AFL media subs desk and probably not tweeted it out off his own personal account, I think he probably would have saved himself a lot of a lot of stress, and he you know, probably would have had a weekend where he would have been fine, because it all sort of happened over his own social media accounts.
But don't you reckon that this has actually been good for Mitch? I think it's been great for his profile. It just shows that he's
report
ruthlessly and in the right way. And I think that the sentiment of the public is they have very little sympathy for people that stuff up in the hubs. Like, you know, there's people losing their jobs in Melbourne. There's people all over the country that are really struggling. And what you've got a wife of a player who is going to a day spa, putting it on social media, then deleting it, and then the club complaining and telling us that we need to take that photo down, even though it's already gone on social media and it's cost the club $50,000. Like, please spare me all that. Like, I couldn't believe it when Richmond called me and said, oh, can you take the photo down? I said, it's gone on social media. Like, once it's on social media, it's out there.
It's out there. And
even if it's not on social media, there is someone in your bubble who's cost the club $50,000, and I don't care if that person is a player or not. They are there because they are part of the Richmond Football Club family. Now, it's understandable if that person is under the age of 18 and a minor. But for an adult to make this mistake, and then for a club to pretend, in my opinion, pretend that it is not important that that is part of the story, is just completely skewed. And it just is, again, it speaks to the nature of the AFL business that we're in, when we're too worried about hurting people's feelings sometimes, instead of actually getting to the truth and getting to the bottom of what the story is.
Yeah, so Tom, briefly on that, I agree with you, but I'll play devil's advocate. Do you understand when a club or the AFL or someone makes the argument that, I mean, there is often a mental health component to all of this, where being scrutinised by the media is a painful experience?
Absolutely agree. And I've never felt it on that level, but I can imagine that being scrutinised by the media when you're not in the public eye, like Brooke Cotchin is not, because she's not a footballer, would be a shocking experience. But and I don't know the answer to this, but at what point are you not allowed to report on something because it might hurt the feelings or affect the mental health of someone else? So I said to Richmond when they said back to me, I said to Richmond when they said, you know, it's potentially a mental health thing, I said that is, if it's a proper mental health issue, then I completely understand. So just I completely understand that. But I was told, no, you know, it has the potential to be harmful and all this sort of stuff. So I don't know. Look, you know what? If someone made an error in Melbourne in a normal season that was the partner of a player and they weren't abiding by club rules, then I think you could probably leave that person's name out, because they're not in a football bubble. But when they're in a football bubble, I've got, not a lot of sympathy for these people making errors, whether it's Nathan Buckley or players or partners or players.
Well, the good thing is we've still got footy, and there's still action going on the field, and we're sort of a third of the way through now our footy frenzy, with round 10 kicking off on Monday night, with Port Adelaide getting a hard-fought, a gutsy victory in the end over a pretty plucky Bulldogs outfit. But we're kind of lucky still, Maxie, that we've still got some games to dissect. And, you know, we've all, over the next couple of weeks, we've got a game every night. Really looking forward to Richmond and the Brisbane Lions on Tuesday night. People talking about a potential grand final preview, which should be awesome to see. But you've done the run home on foxfooty.com.au, which went up on Sunday night. And it's always good to get a bit of a gauge about which teams are well placed. Now, all things going to plan, how your run home works is that we do get the 17 round season where everyone does play each other once, and that's, you know, all things hopefully going to plan. If it does work out like that, which teams, certainly towards the top end of the ladder, are well placed to try and cement those top four spots?
Yeah, so obviously it's difficult to analyse a fixture that doesn't exist.
Yes.
The games that we know are coming, for example, GWS, who I think have the easiest remaining fixture based on the average percentage of their opponents, is the way I figured that out.
Yep.
They've got to play Adelaide at some point, Fremantle at some point, etc. We don't know for certain where they're going to play those teams. You assume Freo in Perth because they're going over there. But I've analysed them as if it's a neutral site game. So they're playing somewhere that is not favourable to either. So the Giants have a really good chance of getting to the top four. I don't have them doing it because when you're predicting these things, I don't tip every game because I'm never going to get 9 every round. I give a percentage chance. But the Giants could arguably be favoured in every game except one. in their last eight.
Yeah.
They've still got to play West Coast, but they've got Essendon and Sydney coming up, Adelaide, Carlton, Fremantle, Melbourne, and then St Kilda and West Coast are the two tricky ones. But you can very easily see even a Giants side without Toby Green for a couple of weeks winning a bunch of those games. And then at the top, I think St Kilda's going to make the top four. I think it's they've got a really strong percentage at this point. They've got a relatively tough fixture, but enough games that they can win. And as long as they hold firm, they're staying in Queensland over the next 3 weeks, which really helps. They've got to play West Coast at some point. And whether they play West Coast in Perth or in Queensland might end up deciding whether they get a double chance or not, I think.
Jeez, it's going to be a frantic run home to from that perspective. What about, are there any sides in danger of missing out? You know, we've sort of, sort of the Dogs go down again. Collingwood have been sort of, certainly the big story in the Monday night shows. Both off the field and off the field. Off the field and on the field. They've, you know, dropped, it's been a horror two games for them in Perth, and they now head to Queensland. Is it? It looks like their top four chances are now in jeopardy, and you know, there's now some talk. Are they capable of playing finals?
Yeah, it's definitely going to be difficult. But they've got in this weird little patch of games coming up. It's really interesting because they're so out of form, but they've got all their easy games. And you would have thought Fremantle was an easy game, but the Dockers in Perth are a much tougher opponent than elsewhere. So as long as they can beat Sydney, Adelaide, and Melbourne, you'd expect they would over the next three. They should climb back in the eight and they should be okay. They've got a couple of tricky games. They're still going to play Brisbane. They're still going to play Port. And even Carlton on its day can be a very dangerous opponent. But I would trust the Magpies would make it back in. And really, that's the only change I see to the eight. I think the eight we have right now, Port Adelaide, Brisbane, St Kilda, West Coast, Richmond, Geelong, GWS, Bulldogs. I think the Bulldogs go out. I just don't trust them. They're a bit too inconsistent. Their percentage is 92 right now. They were pretty good against Port, but not quite enough, and I spoke about Josh Bruce last week, of course. So I think Collingwood replaces the Dogs, and then I think that's the top eight. I don't know who else would climb in. Essendon, I don't know, Tom, is there any team you like that's sort of on the fringes of contention that could jump in, or do you think stay
Collingwood aside? Collingwood's the only one, I think. I don't think Essendon is quite consistent enough yet. I can't quite trust them, so it's sort of hard to say categorically I think they will jump in. I don't think the Gold Coast will make it now. As much as I like their work, I think they'll win a few more games. Melbourne have a game in hand. So, you know, there's a bit of talk on Melbourne 15th on the ladder. Well, they're 15th with a game in hand. So you need to keep that in your mind. Same as you do with Essendon, I guess. But I still think Melbourne will be 5-5 in 2 weeks, and they'll be playing Collingwood in 3 weeks or in three games coming to the back end of their little 14-day stint. So they'll... If there's ever a time to get Collingwood, it's when they've played three games in the previous 13 days or whatever their run of games is. So I'm not ruling out Melbourne, but I think it's unlikely based on the way they look. But no, the only team I can say confidently that's not in the eight that I think will make the eight is Collingwood. But then I look at the eight and I don't really know who they're going to replace. They're playing some ordinary footy, the Pies. They were premiership favourites about a month ago. I remember Brad Johnson said on Saturday Stretch that they're clearly the best team in it. And now they're absolutely nowhere near it. Brisbane and Port are that much better than the Pies at the moment. The Saints are playing that much better, and West Coast clearly, given what they did to them. So I say confidently that Pies are going to make it, but they'd have to get their act together pretty soon.
Who wins the flag from here, guys? Like, have West Coast now sort of got themselves into a position where they're going to be hard to beat, or is it still sort of...
I'm still Port.
Port?
Still pegging Port, just because I don't want to change, and I love the way they're playing. I love Ken Hinckley. And they're great to watch. Even last night when they were challenged against the Dogs, they responded really well. So I am still sticking with Port, Max.
Yeah, they've got a good, consistent game style. It's an interesting word that you guys keep using on First Crack, by the way. Brisbane, you have to take into account that they could have the grand final at the Gabba and a lot of finals in Queensland. That's going to be a huge benefit. And maybe where the grand final's played swings the flag to either Brisbane or West Coast. I think West Coast's win over Geelong was a lot more telling of their quality than the Collingwood win. The West Coast Collingwood game was very clearly West Coast at their absolute best, Collingwood at their absolute worst, thus the massive margin. West Coast is a premiership contender quite clearly, but they're not so far away from the pack. And they're going to play a bunch more games away from home, we think. I mean, Adam Simpson has been saying for a little while that he expects they'll have to spend more time in Queensland, probably end the season there. So I'm going to tip Brisbane, but not with a whole lot of confidence, because I think realistically there's about seven or eight teams that I could see still winning the flag.
think Richmond are a huge chance against Brisbane tonight to make a bit of a statement. The Tigers seemingly sort of got their game back over the past couple of weeks and look like a team that that certainly might be able to challenge there. They've had an inside 50 differential of plus 17 per game over the past four games, which means that they're getting the game on their terms. Their fourth half game is back. The likes of Bolter, Pickett, Arts, Chole, Shea Bolton, they're all sort of starting to come to the fore, and Ashby's still going to come back. Mate, a little bit delayed now, it looks like, but Hooley, Edwards, Prestia. The Tigers are the kings of peaking at the right time of the year, so I don't think we can rule out Richmond yet. They're looking pretty strong.
It would help if Jack Riewoldt would come into form. I think that would be a really big deal, because that is their issue, is converting those inside 50s, and if he and Lynch start firing, then the Tigers should be their top contenders.
It'll be a great game on Tuesday night. If you're listening to us before the Brisbane and Richmond game, it'll be on Channel 504 from 6 p.m. with Jared Whateley and Mark Robinson and AFL 360 before handing over to Hutto and the team. But now on the Fox Footy podcast, it's time for Australia's favourite segment, Fair or Farce.
Was that dangerous by Sebastian Vettel? Farce. 5 second time penalty.
Excellent. Here we go. Just a quick fair or farce today. I've got a bit of feedback that it's been going for too long. So
too self-indulgent?
Where's that from?
Just a bit of feedback. I'm not going to read out any mail today. I've got a bit of feedback as well that I've been reading out too much mail. Max Lawton. Anyway, fair or farce. Ben, you can't notice the difference with commentators calling the game off TV. Fair or farce?
No, you can't. I think it's fair. So I suppose got a really good insight into this when the NBL last season went into a hub situation when ESPN had the rights and the NBL sort of have done their own production. There was some outcry, I suppose, at the start of the NBL season that they actually weren't at games. But it very quickly calmed down. Now, this season, there's actually no choice for broadcasters to actually broadcast games based in where they are, back at home. So for Bruce McAvaney, that's in Adelaide. Brenton Speed called the Suns and the Giants from Sydney, I assume, on Sunday as well, and all the Melbourne-based commentators are doing it from there. You can't notice anything. I think as long as you've got someone on the ground, and you know, with their feet on the turf to do those interviews, but to also pick up, I think Lynchy and Dicko in particular, we're biased towards Fox Footy, but their insights at ground level, particularly Dicko, I watched the North Melbourne Adelaide game and how he was able to convey what was happening from a ground level perspective was awesome. And then from a play by play perspective, it's the commentary I don't think has never been better, really. And then I think the camera angles that special comments people are looking at in these commentary hubs there's a wide lens. Like, so for instance, you'll see something on the telly that normally commentators would see at the venue, but because they've actually got other camera angles that they're looking at, they're also picking that up and adding that extra layer of insight. So for mine, you certainly can't notice a difference.
Can I ask is Ben Dixon the only person in Australia who's able to cross state borders? He's been doing games in Sydney and Brisbane, hasn't he?
I think he's moved. So he did originally. He was the New South Wales guy for us.
Yeah.
But now that all games have been taken out of New South Wales, he's pushed into Queensland, and he's him and Lynchy are the dynamic duo up on southeast Queensland, doing a really good job on the boundary, giving great insight.
There you go.
Love Dicko's work. Max, fair or farce? Jack Steele should have been in my mid-year All Australian team.
Oh, fair. You did a terrible job, Tom. You're an absolute disgrace. Look, he has a very fair argument. And to be honest, I've missed some of these numbers about how good the Saints midfield has been and how good Steele has been. But if you're going based on that, he's been a real driver of their success. So he's definitely a contender. I think you would have had him, if you were picking a 40-man squad, he would definitely be in there.
Oh, yeah.
And I think a lot of the players who were notable snubs, which happens with the real All-Australian team for what it's worth, would have been in that squad. So, yeah, I could see him being in there, but there's a couple of criticisms that you copped that I'll defend you from. So,
thank you.
So, one, putting Dusty and Dangerfield in the team. Oh, you've put them in there because of their name value. No, if you look at their stats, they're still incredibly good players and some of the best in the comp, right?
They're victims of their own talent.
Yeah,
I really like Dusty at centre-half forward. I thought that was strong, because I don't think that proves that's sort of the modern-day forward line setup.
Yes. Yeah, and he's definitely being compared to his 2017 season sort of thing, where Dangerfield being compared to his Brownlow season as well. It's very strange. The other one is Josh Kennedy not being in the team.
Yeah.
And there sort of seems to be an assumption that the Coleman medal winner slash leader has to be in the team. But A, we've seen this season how being a key forward is almost less important than it ever has been to a football team structure because you've got guys like Tom Papley and Charlie Cameron dominating.
Yeah.
And the second thing is Kennedy's kicked about 15 goals in three games, but the rest of the season he was not really that important. And if you're picking someone into an All-Australian team off the back of three games,
yeah,
as compared to Charlie Dixon's importance to the structure of Port Adelaide and the improvement of Port Adelaide, to me, that's an easy decision between those two. You can't.
Max, I love how you're speaking my language. I mean, I thought about Josh Kennedy a lot. I mean, I could have had Kennedy or Hawkins at full forward. And I'm like, I'm just picking that for a structure rather than them actually deserving it. And lots of people have said, oh, he's Coleman medal leader. But you're right. He's performed really in 30% of the season. So it's not enough yet. When you're the Coleman medal leader at the end of the season, you're probably more likely to perform in close to 50 or 60% of the season, at the very least. So then you sort of have to be selected. But after nine rounds, I just didn't think he'd done enough in the first month and a half of the year. The other criticism I got a lot was why have you selected Max Gawn and Todd Goldstein in the same team? And that's because I think Gawn's been slightly better than Goldstein, but I also think Goldstein deserves it. So if you're not going to have another key forward along with Dixon, then you may as well get Goldstein in and they can just rotate through forward, ruck, and bench.
And over the past 2 years, Max Gawn and Brodie Grundy have been on the same team for the past two All-Australians. And they've swapped either year with who's been the starting ruckman and who's been on the bench. And if he'd said pre-season that Dan Butler would be on the interchange bench of the All-Australian team,
totally
deserved. And Christian Petrarca would be the starting rover in the team, you'd be laughed in your face. But that's just a credit to how those two players have performed this season.
Yeah, and I to give you an idea of how I did this team, I sat there on Sunday night and I went through it and I selected my own team. And then I verified some of the selections with Jacob Wilson from Champion Data, who's a gun.
Loyal man.
And I took a couple out. I think it was about three or four changes from what I had initially, just because there was some guys like they're off-Broadway because they're not Victorian, and the Victorian media is so powerful. But Sonny Walters is having an incredible year as a midfielder. So I actually couldn't leave him out. So I had to sort of include him. And the other one that Jacob was very big on was Hugh McCluggage on the wing.
Yeah.
Genuine. I always like it when all Australian teams have genuine wingers. So there's a couple of people said, oh, what about Jack McRae? But Jack McRae is just an inside. It becomes sort of an inside mid. So he's not a winger at all this year. So anyway, always good to get feedback. Always funny when you get feedback and someone says, oh, what about Andy McGrath? You've got no idea. Then you look at their profile and they've got a red and black thing.
Yeah.
No one supports players from other teams. You don't have Geelong supporters saying, oh, what about Josh Kennedy? it's very funny. Ben, fair or fast? North Melbourne need to bring Ben Brown back in this week.
No, that's a farce. Purely based, though, on health and injury at the moment. So probably I think the only way that Ben Brown gets back into the side at the moment is dependent on how Nick Larkey and Majak Dore pull up. So Larkey copped an ankle injury late in the game against Adelaide. So it was minor, according to the coach after the game. So it depends on how good he gets up. And, of course, Majak played his first game, and what a brilliant first game it was in 700 days, first AFL game in 700 days. So depending on how those two pull up, if one of them isn't fit, I think Brown naturally comes in. But when you kick, and I understand it was against an Adelaide team that were insipid, but when you kick 19 goals for the highest score of the entire season without Ben Brown in the side, and it's a winning formula and you win by 69 points, I think ultimately you don't have to make too many changes to your side.
Good call. And last one, Max, and this is one very close to your heart, along with a lovely family member of yours.
Is it about wrestling?
Fair or farce, Hawthorn is back.
Farce.
Well,
it was never as bad as it seemed, and one pretty good win over Carlton doesn't mean they're back as contenders. They're still middle of the pack. They, I don't think, will make the top eight. They've got, let's have a look at their fixture. It's middle of the pack for difficulty. Still going to play a couple of games in the West. Hawthorn's an okay team, but they're not as good as their age profile says they should be, and that's the problem. You know, they still need to go into a rebuild because you look at the teams that are succeeding with a bunch of young talent right now, and that's where they want to be in a few years' time. So they're fine, but that's not an interesting headline.
No, they're fine is not an interesting, and you do write headlines for a living. Max and Ben, that is the end of a slightly condensed version, just like the AFL season of Fair or Farce.
Yes, on brand, on theme, as always, Thomas, well played. Maxie, a few questions from the mailbag, as per usual.
Yes, thank you to everyone who tweeted in. We tweet out the call for questions on your Monday afternoons, so tweet us in, and you could be like Kyle, who asks, who is your pick for the rising star this year? How good could Caleb Sarong be?
He really put his name up, didn't he, on Sunday? I think Fremantle's, the best thing about Fremantle's win was, while Fife was excellent, he wasn't clearly a best on ground. He had 18 contested possessions. The guy's insane. But this was driven by a lot of other different players, and Sarong was crucial in the guts
there. How good's Caleb Sarong? I love watching him.
He's outstanding. For mine, though, I still think Isaac Rankin's got a number of really impressive games left in him. I think the Suns have, over the past couple of weeks, have just sort of been waiting for a big game from him. I think he's still got, he's the kind of player that he's sort of got this body where some younger players might drift off. I think he actually might get better with the more games and he plays and the deeper it goes into the season. So for mine, I think Isaac Rankin's got some big games in him that'll seal in the rising star.
Yeah, the only ones I could see pinching it from either Sarong or Rankin are Max King, who actually hasn't been nominated yet, but if he has some really big games down the stretch, gets into the public consciousness, that'll help him. He's looked very impressive. And the same thing for Mitch Georgiades, who is fantastic against the Bulldogs. And I think he's only played 3 or 4 games, but he's really promising and filling in that role that Todd Marshall was playing in the forward line alongside Charlie Dixon. So if he, again, kicks a few big bags, he could get into the mix as well. So it's a pretty good class for the rising star this year. Connor Butterick is not getting a lot of attention, but a really interesting player from the Suns as well. And obviously Matt Rael had a Brownlow worthy first 4 games.
I feel like the 2018 and 2019 drafts and its early days are just going to give us so much joy in the future. Yeah. You know, sometimes you get a couple of drafts where you get some good players out of it, but you don't get your sort of generational players. I feel like there's a few coming. Oh, there's a few that have already arrived, and we're going to just see the best of them in the next 10 years.
Yep. Jordan asks a more broad question than specific for this season. Who do you believe is the greatest team to never win a premiership? Ben, I could guess who you would name, but would you like to pick?
I'd be interested to know what you think I would think, but for mine, it's probably the Saints of... I'm just trying to, well, probably, the Cats of the late 80s and early 90s probably goes without saying. But for my lifetime that I've seen, it's how the Saints sort of didn't capture a flag in the mid-2000s and then the early sort of late 2000s and early 2010s. That's one they'll just be kicking themselves. I always thought heading into the first 2010 grand final, they would definitely get that game, and then once the draw happens, I always kind of had the sense that Collingwood have a big win the week after. So for mine, I think St Kilda would be kicking themselves that team of that era didn't get a flag.
I think the Melbourne team of 2000 was very unlucky. Oh, they came up again. No, joking. On a slightly different note, if I can change the question for a second, I agree with Ben's answer, by the way. Sure. I think that the team that should have won more flags, if that's such a thing, is Essendon of 99, 2000, 2001.
Yes.
They were awesome in 99. Fraser Brown cooked them in the end in the prelim final, and they cooked themselves on the day of a Victorian state election, I'm pretty sure, as well. And then in 2001, I mean, I know it was the start of Brisbane's dynasty, but they were awesome as well, the Bombers, and they had to win more than one flag in that little period.
So my call that I was expecting from you was, of course, the 2008 Geelong Cats.
Well,
I was thinking specific season, I'm thinking.
Yes. How I read it was when it said team, it's like a team of that era that didn't actually capture any flags. So you could think, Essendon, I think, is clearly a team that should have won 2 or 3 flags in late 90s, early 2000s. I think Geelong would be kicking themselves that they didn't win at least 4 during that era. But for mine, the fact that St Kilda didn't capture any during recent times would be one that Saints fans no doubt still lament.
Yes, fair. 21 wins, 161 percentage. Jeez. Nice.
Yeah.
I'm never going to get over that grand final. One more. Just going back to the All-Australian squad briefly, because this is another name that we didn't mention in that little chat. This is from Jackson. Thoughts on Luke Ryan being in the All-Australian squad at the very least?
Yep. Yeah, no, Luke Ryan's had a great year. I think he's the number one intercept player in the comp, or if not two. Very reliable in a back line that has been under siege all season. They've had no Alex Pearce, no Joel Hamling all season. Griffin Logue out for most of the season. Brennan Cox in and out of the side. Their back line has been absolutely depleted. So Ryan's almost had to sort of play a little bit above his height and a little bit outside of his natural intercepting role. But he has been very, very solid, barely played a bad game. Obviously had that mishap pre-season where he was sort of caught up in that those young Fremantle players that breached the protocols, but barely put a foot wrong on the field this season, and certainly I think should be right up there in calculations.
I think I had him in the conversation. In the end, I went for Sam Collins, who according to Champion Data, again off Broadway, but he's the number one key defender in the comp. Mm. Darcy Moore, I think, has the best balance between defence and attack. I mean, he's probably a little bit more offensive. And then Harris Andrews, I just love the way he spoils and sort of doesn't get outmarked. So I couldn't fit him in, but I think Luke Ryan has to be in the conversation if his form continues for the back end of the year.
And as we said before on this show, the All-Australian defence is always about, there's like one or two players who are picked every year, Harris Andrews turning into one of those, Jeremy McGovern has been, and then you have the first-time selections, there's a few of those, and you get some who miss out, so I reckon Collins or Ryan, you'll probably only get one of them in the team.
Yeah, great.
Even though they could arguably deserve it both.
Yeah.
Hey, Ben, can I ask you a question? Not a mailbag question, but this concerns you. So yes. Dale Thomas sent a tweet this week referencing one of your articles where you wrote that Billy Gowers had joined a rare club for his ordinary game against Richmond, referencing his Supercoach score that night. And Dale Thomas's tweet was, this sort of, and in quotation marks, journalism, or lack thereof, pisses me off to no end. For everything great that has happened in the game last night, Ben, you decide to start a pile-on on a player who had a rough night. I'd love to see your super coach rating playing half forward against the reigning premiers. And there's a fair bit of pile-on here, Ben. Like Tom Boyd tweeted and Scott Pendlebury liked Dale Thomas's tweet. And it sort of all broadly referred to Billy Gower's mental health after your article. How were you when you were reading those, and would you have done anything differently if you had the time again?
Well, Tom, I'm all right. Thanks for asking. I've never experienced a social media backlash like that before. I had to turn Twitter notifications off for about 36 hours. I couldn't believe it, to be honest. And this is not about me.
I'm asking about you first.
I understand. So I suppose normally, sometimes when an article is bagged, it's often like the organization's Twitter account is quote retweeted, or there's replies to that. But this was done to me personally. So that was hard to take, and it was pretty hard when Mum's sort of calling you saying, "Have you seen this?" So I told Mum to stay off Twitter for. I told Mum to stay off Twitter for 36 hours. I'm not sure how successful that was. Look, would I have done something different? Ultimately, it was a factual story. What I wrote was, there was nothing factually wrong in what I put there. Would I have done something differently? I probably may have been able to get something a bit more from the Dogs in terms of whether that was, you know, a comment about Gowers or specifically. But, you know, it probably wasn't quite strong. On a player that has been in and out of the side, has been on the fringes and struggling to get in there. Having said that, the Bulldogs put in one of their worst performances of the season against Richmond. And I suppose journalism is all about telling people something that they don't already know. And because Champion Data's records are sort of kept to themselves unless they're requested, I felt it was quite interesting because it was certainly a topic of conversation throughout the night and certainly afterwards. About the player ratings that came through, not only from Gower's perspective, but, you know, how good was Dustin Martin's one, which I think was in our original story. What I didn't say back to Dale was that, you know, because you don't want to make a big deal of it, but I wrote a story about Noah Bolter hours beforehand, how Damien Harbutt compared him to a young Alex Rance and how good his game was and how good the likes of Pickett and Bolton and Arts had really stepped up for Richmond's perspective. And we also covered Dustin Martin quite extensively the night before as well. So So it wasn't a case of me just purely picking out the negative aspect of that. I also felt that we also needed to have a Bulldogs themed story on that night, because the Bulldogs had a pretty ordinary performance, and it was worth sort of covering Luke Beveridge's comments, which I did. Luke Beveridge's comments are in there, also some commentary from Fox Footy as well. So look, I'm all right. Would I do something different in the going forward? I probably mightn't do something on a player that has been in and out of the side, to be honest. Having said that, you know, Gowers was the Bulldogs' leading goal kicker back in 2018, and should be a really key part of this Bulldogs outfit that is struggling for goal kickers and forward options at the moment. So an interesting few days, to say the least.
Well, it also speaks to a bit of a broader problem that the Dogs have had this year with very weird selection decisions. As you said, Gowers had a great 2018. I think he's played a couple of games this year. And against the Suns, he had that very dangerous kick in the final minute that almost cost them a chance of winning the game.
Yeah.
And then he had a very poor performance. And I understand the argument of calling out a specific player by writing an article about their performance, how that is viewed. But this is a comment I've seen for a lot of Bulldogs fans I follow on Twitter. It's a topic of discussion among Bulldogs fans. Why was Billy Gowers being selected? Why are these players being selected over these players? Why is Luke Beveridge playing so many debutants this season? It's a big topic for a team that many people had in the top four and instead might miss the eight. So, you know, you can't write off all scrutiny as unfair.
Yeah, and it goes back to that question that you posed at sort of in our pre-fair or fast discussion, yeah, Tom, about what is, when does it sort of get too far from a mental health perspective? Ultimately, as reporters and, you know, pundits struggle with this a lot as well, this balance of they only call what they see on the field. And for instance, I think Mick McGuan even sort of flagged that when he was commenting about Jaden Stevenson to the Herald Sun yesterday. He's only judging by what he sees on the field. So like, we can't, particularly while we don't have, well, we're based in Melbourne and, you know, teams are based in interstate at the moment. We sort of, it's very difficult to get inside camps at the moment and understand where every single player on every single list is at, unless it's sort of publicly put forward. And, you know, there's so many games happening at the moment in the footy frenzy that are back-to-back that we just sort of have a look and see and judge on merit from what we see. And I wasn't judging, to be honest. Like, I've got nothing personally against Billy Gowers. It was just presenting the numbers and reporting the facts, ultimately, in the end. Absolutely nothing personal against Billy Gowers at all. It was just simply clearly a talking point among dog supporters that I try to take a step further.
Yeah, it's interesting. And also, you did well not to reply, because you're never going to win in that situation. If former players or current players are having a go at you on social media, like a bit what I said before, people hate the AFL, but a close second are the media and journalists. So it's not worth trying to start an argument. But I think if you were to, what you said just before about writing an article about Noah Bolter is probably a good place to start. But I like your honesty, Ben. I think we're all learning in these situations. It's an ever-changing landscape. And what you write and what you don't write often comes down to one question, and that's, is the juice worth the squeeze?
Yes.
I've learned many times, often it's not worth the squeeze, or it's worth the squeeze in a slightly different fashion. And I think that's probably the conclusion you've come to.
Yeah, no doubt. No, that's definitely the conclusion though, that I've come to, Tom. But thanks for checking in. And I had some very nice messages, it has to be said, from friends, but also some senior journos at other companies as well, which was really nice to hear. So thanks for all that. But we'll just quickly run through the rest of the games around 10. I think that might be the best way to go. We've got Lions and Tigers tonight for the Shane Morrison Cup. Who takes that one out?
I'm tipping the Lions, Max.
I'm worried about how Charlie Cameron will do, because he's had some poor games against the Tigers in last year. So I'm tipping the Lions, but not with a huge amount of confidence.
Geelong and North Melbourne for the Cameron Thurley Cup.
Geelong.
Yeah, both teams off four-day breaks, I think. Geelong for me.
Cameron Thurley. Yeah, Ben, you've extended yourself here.
Well, and you really like this one. Adelaide and Melbourne, of course. There's a lot of players you can go for. You know, Peter Vardy, of course, is one of the main ones, along with James Seller. But, of course, for the John Neeson Cup, this will be played on Wednesday night.
Melbourne.
Melbourne fans are terrified about this game.
Yep.
Absolutely petrified. And they really should win, and they might not. So I see why. But I'm tipping them.
Nervous, Tom?
No, not nervous, because I'm not that emotionally invested, no.
Oh, okay. Right. Collingwood and Sydney on Thursday night for the Robert R. Matt Cup.
Collingwood, for me.
They should respond, the Magpies, you would think.
Rebound effect in full play.
Yeah, I think the Swans, their last four games, have conceded 53, 53, 53, and 54 inside 50s. It's actually remarkable they've escaped the close loss and a close win. That's their last four games, and Collingwood coming off, they'll be wanting some redemption. I think it could get really ugly this game on Thursday night. I'm not sure it'll get ugly, though, for the Andrew McWalter Cup between the Gold Coast Suns and St Kilda at Metricon Stadium.
Yeah, I'm going for St Kilda here, and I just want to say 53, 53, 54 sounds a bit like a list of batting averages across series for a young Steve Smith before he became Don Bradman.
Sort anyway, of Michael Bevan ODI kind of averages there.
Yeah, there's lots of not outs. I'm going for the Saints here.
Sorry, was that cricket? Is that what we were...
No, that was cricket.
Okay, I'm catching up. St Kilda.
And then Essendon and the Giants finish off the round with a Kurt Ayliss Cup.
The Giants for me, Max and Ben.
Yeah, I don't love either of these teams, but I will pick the Giants.
Yeah. Well, that's been a very big edition of the Fox Footy podcast. A lot to take in, both on and off the field. But, of course, you can keep right across it on Channel 504 and, of course, on foxfooty.com.au.